The private sector created a lot of jobs.
But what's it going to take to get the unemployment rate down?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org, and it's Friday, November 5th.
The economy added 151,000 jobs in October. Analysts expected a much smaller gain, but the percentage of people out of work didn't budge. The unemployment rate remains at 9.6%, according to the latest Labor Department report.
With some analysis now on what the report says, let's bring in Chris Lowe, as we do every Friday. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, and he joins us this morning live from Hershey, Pennsylvania. Chris, have you had any chocolate yet this morning?
So far, just one Hershey Kiss, but okay. I'll do better than that.
More than me. All right. So the unemployment rate stays the same, 9.6%, but the private sector, we hear, is responsible for an additional 159,000 jobs. You subtract 8,000 government jobs that were lost, and you have the big number, 151,000 new jobs. What does all that tell you?
Well, I think it's good news. There are two separate surveys which complicates things. That's why the unemployment rate didn't move. The jobs number did. They sometimes diverge month to month. They'll come back together down the road. But I think the real news here is that we've got the strongest growth in private sector employment since April. And it is also trending upward over the last several months.
All right. Well, let's hear from the president. He spoke earlier this hour about this report. Let's take a listen.
An encouraging jobs report doesn't make a difference if you're still one of the millions of people who are looking for work. And I won't be satisfied until everybody who is looking for a job can find one.
So he was obviously happy about this number, but didn't want to seem too cheery about it. Chris Lowe, dig into those numbers for us. Where are these jobs coming from?
Well, it's pretty broad-based. Some of the improvement came today because the rate of state and local layoffs slowed down. But digging in, it's on the service side. Manufacturing jobs are still falling, although it was the smallest job loss there in a while. Hmm. But on the service side, retail was up. Transportation was up. The biggest gain was in temporary workers.
All right. Well, Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Qantas said this morning that faulty engine design is likely the cause of yesterday's mid-air engine blowouts. A Qantas A380 jumbo jet was forced to land after one of its Rolls-Royce engines partially exploded. It happened right after the plane took off from Singapore. Now, the incident raises questions about the safety of the A380, which is the world's biggest passenger jet. But now, as Marketplace's David Gura reports, the engine maker Rolls-Royce is under the gun.
Charles Armitage is an aerospace and aviation consultant.
Engines are extremely complex things. They are watchmaking on a 10-ton scale.
He says the A380 is powered by four engines. Airlines get to pick between two manufacturers, Rolls-Royce or Engine Alliance. That's a joint venture between GE and Pratt & Whitney. It's a matter of preference more than anything else. Qantas chose Rolls-Royce for its fleet of A380s. Howard Wheeldon works for BGC Partners in London.
These incidents are extremely rare. They are very serious, and they will be fully investigated.
But he says he doesn't think Rolls-Royce's reputation will be damaged. No company is exempt from engine failures. According to Wheeldon, they happen every 5 or 10 years. Still, several carriers, including Qantas, decided to ground their A380s, and Rolls-Royce's stock price did take a hit. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You may have missed it in yesterday's big rally on Wall Street, but bank stocks jumped especially high. That was thanks to news that the Federal Reserve might let some banks boost dividend payments to investors. Marketplace's Scott Tong joins us now from Washington with more on this. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us, what is the Fed allowing the banks to do here?
To let them cut bigger checks to their investors. A dividend is kind of like interest on your checking account. Say you, big investor Jeremy, you own a share of a bank. Right, you can make money two ways. The stock price can go up and you sell, or the bank can give you a share of the profits. That's a dividend. Now, we all know that the banks lately have been weak. They have frozen or really limited their payouts as the regulators work on new rules to protect their vital organs, their capital. But now these new guidelines on the way from the Fed would begin to unfreeze things. I spoke this morning to Justin Urquhart-Stewart at Seven Investment Management in London, and he says bigger dividends would be a sign of better health.
the economy still has a long way to go. But in order to get there, it needs to have strong banks providing facilities and finance to the economy. So if the means of they're now and they're strong enough to pay dividends, then that's a positive sign for investors and also for the economy.
Okay, a positive sign, Scott. What does this say about the health of the banks?
Well, it tells us that some of them look healthier. A source familiar with the matter tells Marketplace that these new guidelines will be pretty stringent. It's not like we're going to see a ton of banks suddenly boosting their payments to investors. Only the stronger ones whose balance sheets look better. But still, it's one indicator on the dashboard that the banks are getting back to their main job, and that is to pump money through this economy.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, the 5th day of November. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States?
President Obama travels to India today on a 3-day mission to talk about the economy and jobs. It's the first Asian stop on a 10-day four-nation tour. From New Delhi, Raymond Thibodeau reports.
President Obama is set to arrive in India's commercial capital, Mumbai, with a huge entourage of leaders from American corporations, including GE and Boeing. Their mission? To pry open India's markets to more U.S. businesses in defense, banking, retail, and agriculture, and in the process, create more jobs back home. The president's hoping to avoid the O word, outsourcing. It's a hot-button issue here after Obama pushed to end tax breaks to companies that ship American jobs overseas. Indians also bristled when the U.S. nearly doubled the fees for visas that allow thousands of Indians to work in the U.S. Indian Foreign Secretary Narpama Rao points out that the flow of jobs goes both ways.
Thousands of jobs have been created by our acquisitions in the United States. That is something we would like to convey to President Obama and his delegation.
Still, analysts say that might not be enough to convince the more than 13 million American workers without jobs that opening up U.S. trade with India might help the U.S. economic recovery. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Meanwhile, in the wake of the GOP rout of Democrats in the House last Tuesday, the president is sounding a little more conciliatory on Bush-era tax cuts. The White House today said Mr. Obama is considering maybe a 1 or 2 year extension on those tax cuts for all Americans, even those who make more than $250,000 a year.
Moody's and Standard & Poor's are famous for sitting in judgment on the creditworthiness of others. Now, the rating agencies face their own sort of downgrade. There are plans in Europe to cut the agency's influence. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The plans are driven by European resentment over the debt crisis. Many European politicians and officials feel that the problems in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain were aggravated unfairly by the rating agencies. Under the plans unveiled today, the agencies would be much more tightly regulated. They'd be required to give a country early warning before a downgrade. That would give the country a chance to challenge the new rating before it becomes public. Under another proposal, it would be easier to sue agencies if their ratings are judged to be wrong. But Simon Tilford of the European Centre for Reform says the new rules wouldn't change the ratings on many countries.
There are some very, very substantive concerns over growth prospects in a number of economies. And while that remains the case, the ratings agencies will only be doing their jobs if they draw attention to this.
Nevertheless, many concerns remain about the rating agencies' broader role in the financial crisis. Next week in South Korea, the G20 summit will also consider its own crackdown on the agencies. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Steve, here's a story that needs no punchline. A New York cop is suing for slander after he was allegedly caught racing through the streets with his lights flashing and then parking in front of a Dunkin' Donuts.
Apparently a city councilman saw the whole affair, right? And took pictures of it and reported it to news outlets.
And now the cop wants $2 million from the city and the councilman for damage to his reputation.
Watching me.
listening to the Midday Update for Friday, November 5th. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Earnings season continues this morning with profit reports from Beazer Homes, which reported a loss, and Toyota, which reported a profit. If there's been one pattern this earnings season, it's this. Companies that are growing are relying on sales overseas for that growth. We're going to dig into that pattern now with Ron McNeil. He's head of the College of Business and Management at the University of Illinois Springfield. So he's right in the backyard of two global companies, Caterpillar and ADM. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, we've seen earnings in the last couple weeks. Merck says it now gets 18% of revenue from emerging markets. Dow Chemical, Procter & Gamble. This is obviously a trend, but why is there such growth in emerging countries and not here in the U.S.?
Well, emerging markets are coming out of very little. So their consumer markets are great. Any growth is big growth, but when you're talking about populations of 1 billion in India, 1.3 billion in China, even 300 or 400 million people in China buying more makes a huge impact.
So this is really the only way to be at this point. You've got to be a global company.
Right now, the U.S. is about, and Europe and Japan, 51% of the world's market. By 2040, it's going to be India and China is 51%. That's the prediction. Those are emerging markets to build infrastructure, bridges, highways, and a consumer market as that comes along. So you have to think globally.
Do you think it's good for us as Americans that our big companies are making their big money overseas and not here at home?
Well, they need to do both, but what if they didn't make any money abroad and only depended on the U.S. market? Think about the stock market itself. It would go down, and retirees and pension funds would lose money.
Can you survive as a small business that's just doing business in your local community anymore?
Absolutely. There's still a need for those small businesses. And the little companies find their niche. And what they're good at is being very close to the local markets. And if they're very successful and keep adapting, they become bigger companies.
Ron McNeil, Dean of the College of Business and Management at the University of Illinois Springfield, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jeremy.
President Obama called Tuesday's GOP sweep back into the U.S. House control a shellacking, his word. We wondered what that means for climate change legislation that's been floundering in Congress for some time. Marketplace sustainability reporter Adrian Hill is with us now to talk about it. Morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Steve.
So tell me, what will all these Republican newcomers mean for big action on climate change?
Well, probably not as much as they'd like.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, let's be clear. Big climate change legislation was already dead. The Dems controlling both houses couldn't get it through. They tried and failed. So sure, any sort of sweeping climate legislation is less likely now, but that's less likely than dead.
So, Adrian, the Obama administration's EPA is working on greenhouse gas regulations. I mean, what can the GOP-controlled House do about those?
They'll certainly try to do all they can. They might try to kill them. They probably will try to kill them or at least slow them down. The expectation is the House is going to call lots of hearings, spend a lot of time trying to block these guidelines. But right now in the Senate, Republicans and their Democratic allies have as many as 57 votes to stop EPA regulations. That's according to the New York Times. It's not enough to overcome a liberal filibuster, but it could change.
And they're working together, right? Bipartisanship.
Yeah, I guess so. The president did also express some willingness to compromise on energy in his press conference on Wednesday, so we'll see. There's some concern that federal funding for clean energy tech and research could take a hit, that Republicans' appetite to cut the budget, combined with many of their skeptical opinions on climate change, could really mean less money for scientific research. Also, fossil fuel interests, like big oil, spend a lot of money getting some of these Republicans elected, so they're going to be lobbying hard.
Are there any bright spots, Adrian, for proponents of climate change after this election?
Absolutely. Here in California, voters decisively voted against Prop 23, which means that California's clean air laws are going to stay in place. A lot of clean energy advocates are pointing to that as a really significant victory. And it's one sign that the meaningful battle over climate action and clean energy is moving away from the Hill and to the state and local level.
Marketplace's sustainability reporter, Adrian Hill. Adrian, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Major League Soccer continues its playoffs this weekend. The LA Galaxy faces off against the Seattle Sounders on Sunday. 2 years ago, the Sounders weren't even in the league, but now the team's unique business strategy has made it number one when it comes to ticket sales. Josh Plattis reports.
Here at Quest Field, where the Sounders play, the place has the feel of a World Cup soccer final. Every seat is sold out, and the cheering is deafening. What is it about the Sounders? their championship coach, the talented foreign players, that certainly shows up in their level of play. But maybe the team's financial success has more to do with the Sounders' owners, giving fans the power to make some team decisions. Fans can join the Sounders Team Membership Association and periodically vote on whether team management stays or goes. Trip Mickle is with Sports Business Journal.
You're literally an owner of this team. You have a say in how it's run. That's unusual in professional sports.
Sounders GM Adrian Hanauer is one of the managers that can be voted out, but he supports the arrangement.
It all is part of sort of a bigger plan, which is to make sure that our fans are engaged and that they're part of the process.
Since it debuted 16 years ago, Major League Soccer has had a hard go of it. Many teams are struggling to make a profit, but the Sounders typically double the league's average attendance and sell more merchandise than any other team. In Seattle, I'm Josh Plattis for Marketplace.
And finally, it's a big horse racing weekend at Churchill Downs in Louisville. You ever been to Churchill Downs?
Never been to Louisville, as a matter of fact.
Okay, well, so the Wall Street Journal did this research on how profitable horses of certain names have been at the Breeders' Cup since the year 2000. And those horses, Jeremy, that averaged the most money were named after historical or fictional characters. This is according to the paper, like Thor's Echo and Tin Man. You seem so intrigued by this.
I am. I'm waiting to see who the winners are.
Do you know who's favored to win this weekend's race, the Breeders' Cup?
No.
Zenyatta. Zenyatta is named after the 1980 Police album Zenyatta, and we have it queued up. As a matter of fact, Zenyatta Mandata. It was recorded back in 1980. How old were you in 1980?
I was negative two,
and I was like 29.
I was just a twinkle in my parents' eyes at that point.
So that name was on the list's music and dance category, Zenyatta. It didn't even place or show as far as profits go, so it finished fifth in average money. How about that?
There you go. Well, I wonder what's the horse named Steve Chiatakis would get.
I don't think there is
get.
Such a horse, and well, he would be running very slowly right now.
All right. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.